The title of this workshop is Teaching the Great Books, and the comments that I'll be making are drawn, of course, from my own experience. And consequently, I encourage you to see me afterwards for any questions because of the that may have arisen because of the oddity of my ideas. Dr. Grant gave me a great introduction when he mentioned in his talk in Chesterton the quote that talking about serious ideas is a pleasure. And one of the first things that I'd like to say about teaching the great books is something that's appropriate no matter what you teach and how and where. And that is, we should say more broadly, that in education, one of the things that we need to do is teach our students that the discussion of great ideas, the discussion of serious ideas, is not just valuable and important, but a very great pleasure. And so is listening to discussions about great ideas. And one of the things that I'd like to talk about is the teaching of the great books as an introduction to a conversation, to what Mortimer Adler has called a great conversation, and I'll develop that in just a moment. Before I go any further, I'd like to do some defining and tell you what is meant by great books, and then I'll talk about why we should teach the great books and what exactly I mean when I talk about teaching the great books and why I think it's a valuable approach to classical Christian education. First of all, great books does not always mean good books. Many of the books that show up in lists called great books, like the Encyclopedia Britannica great books put together by Hutchins and Adler and that crowd, that are taught at St. John's College, that you see in the Harvard 5-foot shelf of great books and so forth, many of the books there contain ideas that are not good, obviously. Many of them contain ideas that have done great damage to our culture in the 20th century, in the modern world. So when we include those in a list of great books, we obviously don't do so because we mean good when we say great. We must mean something else. And so one of the definitions of great books is books that have been influential or that have been the best expression of certain powerful ideas, whether those ideas are good or not. If those ideas affected our society, affected our culture, and changed the shape of the world that we live in, then it serves our purposes to study them, to read those books, and to teach them to our students, even if we don't want them to believe the ideas contained in those books. So one definition of great is simply influential, a good expression, the best expression of certain ideas. But obviously, another definition of great is good, because many of the books in any list of what we might call great books are there precisely because they contain good ideas. They contain truth and beauty and goodness and not falsehood and ugliness and vice. And in fact, one of the reasons that books wind up on anybody's great books list is because they contain good ideas and not bad ideas, and because good ideas last and bad ideas don't. Sometimes bad ideas last for so long that we think that bad ideas last, but they don't. The books that are on anybody's list of great books now, if you chop off about the last 200 years worth and end your list at about 1800, most of those lists will look the same. If you take the list of the great books in the Encyclopedia Britannica or the list of great books that your local library may issue, and you collate all the lists of great books that you can find, 80 to 90% of the titles will be the same. Homer will be on them all. Shakespeare will be on them all. Dante will be. Virgil will be. Jane Austen will be, and so on. There will be a disagreement, and where the books come from an older era, from the Greek and Roman era, for example, and for the Middle Ages, there will be differences, but largely because we have to choose representative books, not because we disagree with someone else's choices. But the closer you get to the modern world, the more there's genuine disagreement. And the reason for that is that the closer we get to the modern world when we're looking at these books, the more obscured our ideas are by passion and by recent controversy and by simply the nearness of them. So the closer we are to something, the less dispassionate we can be. We won't really know what the great books from the 20th century are for 400 or 500 years or maybe longer. So in our own lifetimes, we can never say for sure what the great books are that will last and take their place with Homer and Shakespeare. We simply can't. We won't live long enough. We can take guesses, and that's a worthwhile thing to do, but we can only take a guess by looking at the benchmark, looking at the list of books that are 500, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 years old, and then seeing what books coming out of the modern world do things like those books or express ideas like those books. But even then, we can't be sure, because perhaps the great books from this era will be books that have expressed things in some new way or put the old ideas together in a new way. So we simply can't know. So the great books are the books that are influential, or that are powerful expressions of ideas, or that have good ideas, and all of those things are reasons to teach them, to study them and to teach them. And the great books generally turn out to be, given what we've just been considering, the great books generally turn out to be those books that have stood the test of time because of some qualities in them. Some of the books that have stood the test of time because of the quality of goodness will always be on anybody's list. 2,000 years from now, if the Lord tarries, a list of great books will contain many books that are on the current list of great books. Some others are more questionable. For example, will Plato and Aristotle still be on the list of great books in 1,000 years? I think probably so. Not because Plato and Aristotle said everything right, or that everything they said was right, but rather they said things very clearly. They asked questions that everybody asks, and they probed issues that everybody probes, but they said it in a more perceptive and more powerful and more observant and more clear way than other people. So until those questions are finally and certainly answered and are no more debated in the end of all things, great expressions of the controversy, of various perspectives in the controversy, will probably always be on a list of great books. Matthew Arnold in the late 1800s, one of the three great Victorians, said that the great books are the best that have been thought and said in the world. That's one good way to look at it, the best that's been thought and said. And if that's so, and if the things that we've been considering up to this point are so, then the books that are great in history, whether they're books of literature or books of history, philosophy, theology, political science, etc., deserve to be studied. And that leads to the next point. The reason we should teach them is that those things that have lasted because they've influenced culture. They've influenced Western culture. And of course, we're only considering here Western civilization. But those things have been influences on the shape of Western civilization. And we are where we are now because of those ideas, because of what Plato said, because of what Galen said, because of what Tacitus said, because of what Boethius said, and Thomas Aquinas, and John Calvin. And because our society is shaped by those things, those things comprise the content of our cultural heritage. We have a heritage. The things that have been said in the past that have made us what we are our heritage. And we have them on our shelves, and we can see the influence of them on the world around us. And so part of our job as teachers is to pass on that cultural heritage to our students. One of the books that I'll be referring to in more detail a little bit later on is Livy's Early History of Rome. And in the beginning of Livy's Early History of Rome, he decries the decline of morals in Rome. And he looks back to the early periods of the Roman Republic. And he longs for the days when there was integrity and uprightness and honesty and thrift and hard work and courage and virtue and nobility. And he says, but in our own day, civilization is like a vast edifice sinking into the swamp of degeneracy and immorality. And he puts his finger on the cause. He says the reason that there's been a decline from back then to now is the lapse of the old teachings. Now, of course, for him, the old teachings were pagan Roman teachings. Many of them were good. Courage, nobility, virtue, honesty, thrift, hard work are very good things. But that's beside the point. The point is that the lapse of old teachings resulted in the decline of the culture, according to Livy. And he's exactly right. We have a heritage. I have books here on the podium. These contain part of the heritage I want to pass on to my own children and to my students. But if I don't teach them what's in these books, if I allow the old teaching to lapse, whatever that old teaching is, they can no longer evaluate it themselves and continue to pass it on and continue to influence their culture. They can no longer try and understand the culture they live in now if I don't tell them what's in the books that have made the culture they live in. if I don't tell them why we think about society and the state and government the way that we do, if I don't tell them why our modern discussions of goodness and evil take the shape that they do, if I don't tell them why the Christian church has such a struggle with Platonism and Neoplatonism in the modern age, if I don't tell them why our epic poetry looks like it does, if I don't tell them why drama looks like it does, if I don't tell them those things, they cannot understand the culture they live in, and they cannot hope to pass on what's good to subsequent generations. So we don't want to allow the old teachings to lapse, the teachings that have made the culture what it is. Now, of course, many things in our culture are bad. Many things are not good. And the bad things we don't want to perpetuate, but we do want to know about them and to understand them. So to the extent that the great books contain ideas that have influenced us, but they're bad ideas, let's say the teachings of Nietzsche in the late 1800s on culture, or of Freud on human nature, or of Darwin on origins, or of Marx on political science. There are four men, very powerful men, who have powerfully influenced the modern age. And although I don't want my children and my students to believe the things that they taught, I want my students to know those names and to know the ideas that are contained in their books so that they can understand why we're in the mess that we're in now. Mortimer Adler, a name with whom many of you are familiar, uses the phrase the Great Conversation. He says that down through history, those who have written and thought well about the ideas that are important, ideas about virtue and vice, about beauty and ugliness, about righteousness and sin, ideas about the individual versus the state. He says that those who have spoken and written and thought well about those ideas are participating in a great conversation, as though it's as though you were to walk into a room where there's some sort of a gathering going on, say a fellowship after church, or a group of friends that you know who have gotten together for a barbecue, and you walk up to a group of people who are engaged in a conversation that's been going on for 15 or 20 or 30 minutes or 60 minutes before you arrived. When you first walk into the conversation, you don't know everything that they're talking about, and you can't make sense of the jokes that are flying about because they're based on things that were said 45 minutes ago. But when you're brought up to speed and somebody says, oh, well, let me tell you about the joke that Fred just said, all of a sudden you begin to understand what the conversation is about. And Adler says that's exactly the position that we're in. There's a conversation that's been going on for years and years. Plato is standing over in this corner with a cup of coffee in his hand, and he's sipping it, and Augustine's shaking his finger in his face, and Plato's backing up, and Cicero is coming over, and he says, let me get involved too. I think you're both wrong. Here's what I think about the condition of the soul in the afterlife. And then John Calvin comes up, and he engages in the conversation, throws in his two cents. And one of the things that would delight me most, one of the greatest pleasures I can imagine, would be to actually see that happening and to be able to sidle up close to them. I think I'd sidle closer to John Calvin than to Plato, but I'd like to sidle up to this group of guys and listen to them talking. But I can do that. I can look at my shelves and I can run my fingers along the spines of my books and I can pull them off and I can listen to the voices speaking about these ideas. And when I hear their voices speaking, I can decide for myself which one is right, or maybe that none of them are right, but the truth is found somewhere in the interface between them all. But to hear their conversation is to open my eyes to how these ideas can be conceived. And what exactly does it mean, for example, to say that man is a moral being? Or what exactly does it mean to say that there's tension between the individual and the state? What exactly does it mean to say that the soul is immortal? What exactly does it mean to say that I ought to do certain things and I ought not to do other things? And to open my books and to read these voices is to have a clear understanding into those questions. Even if the books don't answer the questions, it gives me a clear understanding. And it gives me a clear understanding into how the conversation has continued to shape up. In our world, we hear the conversation continuing to go on in newspapers, in magazines, on television, in passing comments by passersby on the street, in the sermon that you hear from the pulpit every Sunday morning. You hear the conversation continued. And you hear the conversation being continued by people who have been influenced by the shape the conversation has taken, by people who have already decided that Plato was right, or that Thomas Aquinas was right, or that Martin Luther was right on any particular point. And their assumption in the things they say to you has been framed by this great conversation that's been going on through history. Whether they know it or not, they may not have read these books, but the ideas and the shape of the conversation has been handed down to them. So all of these things are things that our children and our students need to be aware of. They need to understand that the things that they believe without even thinking about it, their most deep-seated assumptions, their unconscious, unstated assumptions, unrecognized assumptions about the nature of the world they live in, have been influenced by voices that they can hear. And that these ideas that they have didn't come out of thin air. And they're not necessarily right just because we hold them. They came from somewhere, and this is where they came from. So we want to teach our students to participate in this great conversation. But there's another reason that we should read the great books, and that is not only is this the content of our cultural heritage, but it's the context of our faith, the context of Christianity. Christianity grew up, began coming to fruition and grew up in the Greco-Roman culture that we can read about when we read Tacitus, Suetonius, Josephus, Virgil, Livy, Plato, Aristotle, Homer, and on and on. Our brothers and sisters, our first brothers and sisters who first proclaimed Christ and who first acknowledged each other as brothers and sisters, who suffered under the persecutions brought on them by the Roman emperors, our brothers and sisters lived in a culture that was framed by the books from the ancient Greek and Roman world. And so the things that they said and the things that they thought are things that will only make sense to us when we read the books that they read, when we get an education that's something like the education they had. Here's one example of what I mean by this. Plato, in his book The Republic, has Socrates, his master, discussing with a number of young men the nature of morality. And Plato says in The Republic, the thrust of The Republic is that the internal workings of morality can be sort of broadcast on the wall like an overhead projector in the shape of the state. In other words, the state is a giant metaphor for the inner workings of morality. And in the interrelationship between people within a community, within a republic, within a city, we can see something like the interrelationships between the faculties of my own person, of my own being. And so I can understand internal morality better by looking at external morality within a city. But in the course of this conversation, Plato, speaking with the voice of Socrates, makes it very clear that he thinks about the city in a way that's rather different from modern Western conceptions of the city. For him, the city is a body. It's a corporate entity. It's a body apart from which I cannot live as a human being. And if I'm cut off from the body, like a finger cut off from my hand, I die like the finger dies. And that is the reason why, for example, exile, ostracism, was such a terrible punishment for the ancient Greeks and also for the Romans. When we talk to our students about Themistocles being exiled or Cicero being exiled or Demosthenes, our students are likely to say things like, well, what's wrong with that? I'll pack my bags and go to Florida. I can live down there. It's a good excuse to go someplace else. Because we conceive of ourselves as entirely separate and entirely self-contained, and we don't need to be part of something else. We can pack our bags and take off. We're so mobile, and we're so independent, and we're so self-contained that we don't have the feeling of being part of a body. But the ancient Greeks and the Romans did, and you can see that in Plato. And then Cicero later on in his essay called On Duties talks about this as well when he's discussing virtue. And virtue can only be seen and can only be carried out in society with other people. So this idea of being part of a body, part of a single entity, that gives us meaning in the context of which we find meaning and that helps us to see ourselves as real human beings, that idea was common to the Greeks and Romans. And then along comes the Apostle Paul, who writes to recently converted pagans who are Christians in the city of Rome, in the cities of Galatia, in Ephesus and Colossae and Thessalonica and so forth, people who had been in their own upbringing, in their pagan upbringing, exposed to the ideas of Plato and of Cicero, both of whom were huge influences, of course, on Roman times. People who had this idea of the necessity of being part of a body. And Paul comes along and he says, you know what? You're right. Plato and Cicero were right. We do need to be part of a body, but you're part of a body that will not die. You're part of the body of Christ. And when he said that, he wasn't inventing some new metaphor, and everyone in the audience goes, oh, cool metaphor, Paul. No, he's saying something that speaks to something they already believed in very strongly. And the same thing is true when he talks about the New Jerusalem. We're part of the heavenly city. Now that has that idea has resonances back in way back through the Old Testament, of course, and through the Hebrew mindset and so on. But it also resonates with the Greeks and the Romans because they understood that it's in the city, in the Republic, in the Commonwealth, in society with other men, that we find our meaning and we find our significance and we can live our lives as fully human beings. So Paul talks about being part of a city or being part of a body in such a way that his audience will hear it and say, oh yeah, we've always felt that. But Paul says, you're part of a city that will never fall, never be besieged, never be sacked. You're part of a body that will never die. You're part of the body of Christ, part of the New Jerusalem. So we gain a greater understanding of the force of Paul's discussion in the New Testament if we know what Plato and what Cicero said. Here's another example. When Plato, of course, generally writes with his master Socrates in the dialogues. When he comes to the dialogue, when he comes to the discussion of Socrates' defense speech, when Socrates is brought before the Athenian court and put on trial on charges of having corrupted the youth of Athens and for having been teaching false gods and for atheism to boot, not only teaching false gods but atheism, figure that one out. But Socrates is making his defense speech before the Athenian jury. And in this defense speech, he makes his famous claim that he's the wisest man because he knows the level of his ignorance. He says that it was the oracle of Apollo who told him this. One of Socrates' friends had gone to the oracle of Apollo, and the oracle told this friend of his that Socrates is the wisest man. So the friend comes back, tells Socrates what the oracle said, and Socrates says, that can't be. I know I'm not the wisest man. I don't know anywhere near as much as my friend the artist, my friend the philosopher, my friend the statesman, my friend the rhetorician, my friend the general, my friend the shipbuilder. I don't know as much about anything as all these people do. And I will prove to the oracle that I don't know as much as all these people, and therefore I'm not the wisest man. And so Socrates makes it his business, driven on by this oracle, makes his business to go around and try and disprove the oracle by asking people questions. Tell me, Mr. Statesman, what does it mean to live in a city? What does morality in a city mean? Tell me, Mr. Philosopher, what does holiness mean? And as he talks to all these people, he begins to discover that they don't know nearly as much as they claim to know. And Socrates is forced to come to the conclusion time after time that these people do not, in fact, know as much as they think they do. I still don't know anything about their particular subject, but neither do they. The difference between them and me is I know I don't know about this subject, and they don't seem to. And so finally Socrates, having annoyed all of the citizens of Athens with his questions, is brought up on trial. No surprise there. And in his trial, Socrates explains this. Look, he says, I was driven on. I was driven by necessity. Necessity was laid upon me. Woe to me if I did not do these things because the oracle was pushing me. And he says that in almost those words, the very words that Paul the Apostle uses in 1 Corinthians 11. I think it's 11, maybe it's 9. In first, as it says somewhere in the scripture, and somewhere in Paul, Paul uses almost the same words. He says, woe to me, necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. And it's in the very context of describing how he's driven on from place to place, and he's persecuted, and he's tortured and beaten, and he's suffering on land and on sea. And he says, but I have to do this because I'm driven on by God. And of course, we know the origin of Paul's conversion. And he didn't want to be converted. He was knocked off his horse, and a blinding light shined in his eyes. And God says, who are you that you should persecute me? Why are you persecuting me, Saul? Well, anybody who lived in the city of Corinth, of course, one of the quintessential Greek cities, any citizen of Corinth who had grown up a pagan, become converted to the Christian faith, sat in church on the Sunday when the letter from Paul was written, could not fail to have recognized the echoes with Plato's apology when he heard 1 Corinthians 9 or 11, when he heard 1 Corinthians where Paul is talking about how he's driven on, just like Socrates. And in their minds, they're sitting there in the audience, in their minds they're sitting there and thinking, you know, that's just like Socrates. I understand what Paul is saying. It makes sense to me. And of course, Paul knew what he was doing too because he's familiar with the learning of the Gentiles. In 1 Corinthians 1, in the first chapter, when Paul is talking about wisdom and how the wisdom of man and the wisdom of God are two very different things, and the eloquence of man and the simplicity of man are two very different things. He is echoing also the apology of Socrates, because in the beginning of the apology, Socrates says, I'm going to come to you with plain words, with the words of the marketplace, the agora, the words of the street. I'm not going to talk to you, O jury, like these rhetoricians over here who are my prosecutors in fancy, well-prepared, rhetorical, flashy speeches. I'm just going to talk to you in the words that come to mind. And of course, the jury was very offended because they wanted him to be rhetorical, because that's the expectation. But Socrates says, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to speak in plain words. And later on in the apology, he says, the wisdom of God, and he's referring, of course, to Apollo here, but he says the wisdom of God is a very different thing from the wisdom of man. And any Corinthian Christian listening to this letter being read in Corinth, Paul having written to them, could not fail to have seen those echoes when he hears this letter to the Corinthians. And in the same way, there's echoes in Paul's writing when he talks about ethics and about morality and about the natural man. There's echoes of Aristotle's discussion of the natural man, where Aristotle, in discussing the natural man, is talking about the highest expression of humanity, the highest and best that man can be. And so when Paul is talking about the natural man in his discussions in 1 Corinthians, he's talking about the same thing. He says the natural man cannot understand the things of God. He's not saying the bad man. He's saying the best that man can be under his own steam, like Aristotle talked about. And the Corinthian Christians, again, would be in their minds thinking about the Aristotle they had read when they were in school. So if we read our Aristotle and teach our students to read their Aristotle and our Plato and our Cicero, we're going to be giving them a much better understanding of just what was going on when Paul wrote to these Christians who had been recently converted from paganism, having had a very thorough classical education. And it would be very foolish of us not to teach our students those things that help them to understand the scriptures, the book that gives them all of the information that God wants them to have, the book that contains the words of life, the book that our faith is grounded on. Well, all of this leads to one other point that we should probably talk about, and that is the problem of pagan literature, which continually crops up. And no matter how sure we are that there's good things about it, there's always the question in the back of our minds, is it really right to be giving our students pagan literature? And the answer is yes. But we can give more than that. The initial answer is yes. And for some people, there are those people out there who will question your motives or question your wisdom in teaching students pagan literature. And in some circumstances, perhaps the best answer is just yes, and then hand them a cup of coffee and chat about something else. But for many people, it's a serious question, seriously asked, and it deserves a serious answer. And some of the best answers have been given in the very books that we're talking about here. If we start from the premise that there is such a thing as common grace, that God causes his rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike, that all men have the image of God, the imago Dei, in them, and therefore always get something right at some point. They can't get everything wrong as long as they have the image of God in them. If we start with this premise, then the conclusion we come to will be that of St. Augustine, who said in a number of places in his book, in his Confessions and on Christian doctrine, who said that we Christians who read the works of the ancient pagans are like the Israelites when they were leaving Egypt and going to the Promised Land, when God said to them, go to your Egyptian neighbors and borrow from them articles of gold and silver and clothing, jewelry, earrings, nose rings, whatever they have. Borrow stuff and then take it with you out into the desert. Don't give it back. And God says, and so you shall plunder the Egyptians. And Augustine says God's command to the Israelites to plunder the Egyptians is like what we should do, is a model or a pattern for what we should do with pagan literature. And Augustine makes this very explicit. He says whatever was good in Homer and Cicero and Aristotle and Plato and Galen and Hippocrates, Euripides, Sophocles, Aeschylus, whatever was good in those guys, we should take. Because if it's good, then the source of that goodness is God. Whether that pagan author gave credit to the source or not, we should. We should not imitate that pagan author and not give credit to God for the good thing. That would be equally foolish. So whatever is good in our ancient pagan authors, we should acknowledge and recognize and glory in and delight in. Whatever is bad is chaff and should be thrown out. And consequently, one of the duties that we have as teachers is to teach our children critical thinking skills so that they can separate the wheat from the chaff. And so we have discussions of logic and of rhetoric and so forth in classical education. But that's only one half of the picture. To learn critical thinking skills is to learn how to separate the wheat from the chaff. But in order to identify the wheat, we also have to teach them appreciation. And very often our struggle is even more difficult when it comes to teaching students who have learned their logic lessons very, very well. It's now more difficult than before to teach them to appreciate the very real beauties in Homer, who advocates idolatry. Have to appreciate those beauties, not just to identify the bad stuff. Because it's by the time they finish their logic lessons, and they should have been taught thoroughly, but by the time they finish critical thinking skills, it will be easy for them to throw out the whole book because they can see the bad premises and the bad conclusions, the bad reasoning, the bad theology. But we also need to teach our students that it's infidelity to God to reject beauty wherever it's found, because He is the source of the beauty and of the goodness and of the truth that's in those things. So we ought to follow and use as our model Augustine, who says that we plunder the Egyptians. Where there's goodness, where there's beauty, we accept it and we embrace it and we give glory to God for it. There are some a few other comments that I'd like to make before I get into an illustration of some approaches that I take in teaching the great books. Most of the books on anybody's great books list, well, even this makes me need, I realize I need to back up a little bit here. The great books classes that I teach are comprised more heavily of books in other, that were originally composed in other languages than books in English. For example, I teach a 4-year great books course, and the first year is ancient Greek literature, the second is Roman, the third is medieval, and the fourth is early modern. And it's not until halfway through the fourth year that we get it, well, halfway through the third year, that we get into books that were originally composed in English. You know, late in the medieval section, when we get into guys like Chaucer and Spencer and Shakespeare. And then we get into stuff that's written, was originally composed in English. But for 2.5 years of their great books education, my students are reading books that were written in another language. So we have this difficulty. What do you do about the language thing? For some people, this doesn't even occur to them that it's a problem. But I think that it is, because when we read works in translation, and you can see immediately that this discussion can wander off onto all kinds of other sidetracks. The necessity of studying the classical languages and the value of that, focus and emphasis and priority in education. But for the moment, let me just say this: I think we ought to have at least two reactions to the fact that many of the great books were originally composed in languages that we don't know, that we can't read, most of us. One of the conclusions that we should draw is that we should hope for the day when that won't be a problem, because we will have taught in our homes and in our schools the classical languages so well that we can teach the great books in Greek and Latin. Wouldn't that be great? And I don't think that that's an impossible dream. I think that that's not only possible, but it's something that we ought to be striving for in our schools. I think it's less than perfect, less than desirable, that we should be teaching all of the great books in translation. But until that day comes, we have to do that. And so one of the things that we ought to do when we teach is to give the students a glimpse into what this author originally sounded like when he wrote, what the shape and the form of his thoughts and of words felt like, what it tasted like. Commonly, when I teach Homer, Virgil, Anselm, these authors who have written in Greek or Latin, and less commonly when I get into the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, when we're reading works in other languages like French and Italian, but commonly with the Greek and Latin books, I'll give my students handouts of the original text, the first page of Homer or Virgil in Greek or Latin, so they can look at the words. And I'll read it to them or recite it to them so they can hear what it sounds like, so they can feel the shape of it. And I make a real point of trying to get into my students' heads that the books as they read them are not what the original audience would have heard or read, and that we're not really getting the author's original words. In the same way that when we read the New Testament or the Old Testament, we're not hearing what Paul really wrote or what the church of Thessalonica originally heard. And it's valuable for us to keep in mind that a translation is always a filter. We're always kept at arm's length by a translation. Now, translations can be very good, and we have to work with them, but it's useful to remember that a translation is somebody else's interpretation of the original text. So I make a point when I teach the great books of talking to my students about the original language that the book was composed in and reading to them and showing them the look of it when we do Homer. We always use a translation that I happen to think is the best English one. And we look at it, we read it, we talk about the ideas, we talk about the words, but it's not the same thing as to have done it in Greek. To hear the original language, to hear Menenae de Thea Peleia Deo Achilleos Ulamenein He Muriachaios Salgeathaken Palas Diphthimus Suchasaidi Proiapsen Heroon is not the same thing as to hear Sing, goddess, the anger of Peleus, son Achilles, and its devastation, which put pains thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades, strong souls of heroes. Those are two very different things. They're both poetry, but they feel different, and they felt different to the original composer and to the original audience. And those Greek words feel different than the English words do. The difference in language is important, so I talk a lot about that. Still, we have to use translations, and so the idea, I think, is to look for the best translations, obviously, and that means different things when you're looking at different kinds of books. Poetry and prose require different standards in translation. In poetry, more is always lost in translation than in prose. Even in prose, much is lost, but in poetry, much more is lost because so much of poetry depends on the shape and the rhythm and the feel of the words, and that always changes. English can never hope to exactly duplicate the feel and the shape of Greek or of Latin or French or Italian. And the reverse is true as well. The languages can't hope to sound like English. And so if we were teaching English literature to a class of Japanese students and we were teaching them Shakespeare in a Japanese translation, we'd probably have to labor diligently to let them hear the English. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. And the students would be going, ooh, that's really weird. Do it in the original language. Yeah, but that is the original language. The shape and the feel of words is important, and students need to hear that. But those details having been taken care of, we still have the question of what sorts of books, or what kinds of books to put in the hands of students if we've decided that reading the great books is a good idea. And what I think is this. When we teach our students books, when we teach them literature, the great ideas, as much as possible, and this is true in just about all of the things that we teach our students, as much as possible when they're reading literature, history, philosophy, theology, they should read entire texts. They should read the whole book. They should not read excerpted, edited, abridged versions. And there's a very important reason for that. When an author wrote the book, he imposed on his ideas and on his words an organizational framework that gives it meaning. And the framework of the book is significant. It has significance for the shape of everything inside it. If I were to take, for example, Bede's history of the ecclesiastical history of the English-speaking people, written in the 700s or so, some English monk in northern England, the monastery of Jarrow, who writes about the missionary activity in England and the coming of Christianity to England. He writes his book with an outline in mind, with a shape in mind. And if I were to teach my students Bede by lifting excerpts out, the excerpts that I chose are based on my idea of what's most important in Bede. And so I'm imposing my own organizational, interpretational framework on Bede. I say, this is important in Bede, dear student, and this is important, and this is important, and these other things are less important. So I'm already interpreting when I give them excerpts. And I'm changing the shape. I'm changing what the thrust of the book is, the significance that Bede meant it to have. But if I hand them the entire book and say, here, let's read Bede from beginning to end, then we can talk about the things he said in the book in the context of the whole flow of his thought and the whole organizational structure. The fact that he wrote it in five books, the fact that he begins here and ends here, and the fact that he moves through these various channels and that his thought is framed by these themes has meaning for the individual passages, which lose all their meaning because they've lost the context if I lift them out and give them excerpts. And for that reason, I think that it's best to teach students to read books in their entirety. And I have a real problem with anthologies insofar as anthologies are selections from various authors. Some anthologies are useful, and some authors are simply so big that we don't have time in the reality of life as we know it in schools. We don't have time to have our students read all of the Summa Theologica of Thomas Aquinas, unless we have a class just on that book. And so sometimes you find yourself forced into reading excerpts. But as much as possible, when teaching literature and history, when teaching the books that education is centered on, we should be giving them these primary sources, and we should be giving them to them in their entirety. And this leads to a further observation. Teaching the great books can be the organizing principle, and in fact, in my opinion, it should be the organizing principle in secondary education. The organizing principle in primary education is language. Everything else should be subservient to language. And that is because classical education, liberal arts education, which is the grounding for everyone's growth and maturity intellectually and mentally, liberal arts education is based on the Word. The Word with a capital W, yes, the Word of God, but the Word, language, ideas, which are always conveyed in words. Ideas, sentences, paragraphs, entire essays, entire books, propositional logic is conveyed in words. And so education at the grammar stage should be focused on the Word. And that's why, even though Dorothy Sayers is right, at the grammar stage, grammar can mean all the particulars of various subjects. Historically, grammar meant the grammar of languages, because language is the door into understanding. Language is the door into books. And the ability to read books and think about and discuss and evaluate and delight in the ideas in books is what we want to train students to be able to do for the rest of their life. Education is all about books. It's about books and people. People reading books and then getting together and talking about them. And it doesn't matter what the subject is. There are other things that we have to do in education. But at the center of education is the Word and words. It's language and the conveying of ideas in language. And so at the grammar stage, education should be centered on words. But at the rhetoric stage, education should be centered on books. And it should be whole books, so that students can see the ideas as they were meant to be seen by the author. And they should be in chronological order, so that students can see, for the very same reason, where these ideas fit in the context, in the bigger context of the development of ideas in history. So I would not argue that we should always read books in chronological order when we teach the great books or when we teach literature and history. But I would argue that we should do that at some time, and we should make a point of it at some place in education, and that students should be well aware of the historical and chronological context of the books. We should read Augustine after we read Plato and Cicero, because Augustine depends on Plato and Cicero. If we read the Confessions, I have my students read the Confessions in great books. Throughout the Confessions, Augustine talks about how God is forcing him and shoving him along and changing him and yanking him back. And even though Augustine is rebellious, God is there all the time, and he's using what Augustine is doing to finally bring him to desperation, to a realization of his total lostness and his final glorious conversion story. But the story of that moving and shaping that God is doing to Augustine is a story of Augustine's reading, and he's reading Plato and Cicero, and he talks about how those two authors particularly are influences on his life. So if I were to hand my students Augustine first and say, here, let's read this, they would certainly have a shot at understanding it, but they would have much greater understanding of the book if they were to have read Plato and Cicero, so that they know what those ideas were all about when they come to reading Augustine's immersion in those ideas. And when we read later authors, when we read whoever it is, Jane Austen or Darwin or Robert Louis Stevenson or Charles Dickens, when we read more recent authors, if we've steeped ourselves in older ideas, the ideas they steep themselves in, then they will make much more sense. So I think part of the idea of teaching the great books is teaching not only complete texts so that the ideas are in the context of the author's original organizational principle, but they should be read in chronological order. In some fashion, so that they can be seen in the greater context of history. And I would like to suggest one more thing. The theological argument behind this is based on the premise that God is sovereign over history. There is a reason that Plato came first, and then Cicero, and then Augustine. It wasn't an accident. God wanted it that way. So we should attempt to read history, the history of ideas, the history of political movements, the history of thought, the history of poetry, the history of math and science. We should attempt to read it in the way that God has dealt it out. so that students can see how God has moved and shaped history and culture. I've brought some books with me here today. And having said all these things, many of these things you already know. Some of these things you may or may not have thought about. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time in the remaining minutes showing you some of the ideas that I talk with my students about when I go through the great books. One of the things that I do with my students that I encourage in them, and I'm always greatly heartened to see developing naturally and automatically, is a sense of the connections between things, how one idea leads to another, how one author's ideas connect to another. I like to see in my students, and I like to encourage in them the ability to synthesize, to take this author and this author and say, look how they spoke to the same issue. Here's the subject. Here's what they both said. What an interesting triad we have. The first book that I teach my students in our four-year Great Books course is Homer's Iliad, and everybody's familiar with the Iliad. I just recited to you the famous opening lines. The Iliad is the story of a tragic failure, of a great moral failure on the part of a man who is otherwise great, otherwise a hero, Achilles. The Iliad is an epic not about his nobility or his greatness or his courage. The Iliad is an epic about his tragic moral failure, a grievous moral failure. A failure of pride and of arrogance and of anger. And in the course of the Iliad, this first and greatest of all epics, in the course of the Iliad, Achilles, like all true males, only realizes the destruction he's left in his wake when he turns around and looks after blindly blundering on through the course of 24 books of the Iliad. He destroys his own best friend, causes his best friend's death. He causes the death of many of his own people because of his pride and his anger, as well as causing the death of many of his enemies, but he set out to do that anyway. Well, in the end of the Iliad, the king of Troy, the city that Achilles and the Achaeans are besieging, comes to Achilles, and he begs for the body of his son, his last and his greatest son, Hector, who is the great Trojan hero of the Iliad. And he creeps into camp disguised as a beggar, ushered in by the messenger god Hermes, unbeknownst to any of the other Achaeans, the other Greeks, and suddenly appears in Achilles' tent. And Achilles, his mortal enemy, who has killed dozens of Priam's sons, stares in wonderment as this great man, this mighty warrior, his greatest enemy, the greatest of the Greek warriors, stands there in his... Achilles looks at Priam, the great king, the king of the Trojans, in amazement. And the scene here is the greatest of the Greek warriors, Achilles, and the greatest of the Trojans, the most noble of the Trojans, the king, Priam himself, looking at each other at the culmination of this book when Achilles is still harboring bitterness of the most awful sort in his heart, the bitterness that drove him to withdraw from the fighting and allow his friends to die and allow his own best friend to put on his armor and go out and fight. Achilles is nursing this terrible anger, this terrible bitterness, which hasn't been satisfied by the death of his enemy, Hector, as bitterness never is. Revenge never satisfies bitterness. And Achilles looks at this man, and Achilles' heart is softened for the first time in the entire epic by the words of this man who humbles himself, kneels at Achilles' feet, takes Achilles' hand in his own, kisses it, and says, I put my lips to the hand of the man who killed my children. Priam had 50 sons. Most of them were dead at the hand of Achilles. Achilles' heart softens, and he begins to weep, and he thinks of his own father back home, and finally he breaks down, and after 24 books, he's finally restored to whatever is normal for Achilles, and the story is resolved when this bitterness seeps out of his heart as he weeps next to his enemy, Priam, who's weeping for his sons. And then when they recover from their weeping, Achilles says this to Hector. He says, come and sit down upon this chair, and you and I will even let our sorrows lie still in the heart for all our grieving. There is not any advantage to be won from grim lamentation. Such is the way the gods spun life for unfortunate mortals, that we live in unhappiness, but the gods themselves have no sorrows. There are two urns that stand on the doorsill of Zeus. They are unlike for the gifts they bestow, an urn of evils, an urn of blessings. If Zeus, who delights in thunder, mingles these and bestows them on man, he shifts and moves now in evil, again in good fortune. But when Zeus bestows from the urn of sorrows, he makes a failure of man, and the evil hunger drives him over the shining earth, and he wanders respected neither of gods nor mortals. Later on, he concludes the speech that's begun with this interesting metaphor of this interesting picture of the urns and the dorsal of Zeus by saying, "The Iranian gods brought us an affliction upon you. Forever there is fighting about your city and men killed. But bear up, nor mourn endlessly in your heart, for there is not anything to be gained from grief for your son. You will never bring him back. Sooner you must go through yet another sorrow." So in this concluding speech in the Iliad, Achilles says, you know, the gods really don't care about us. They may not hate us, but they certainly don't love us. They dispense fortune arbitrarily, and we wander over the earth, sometimes moving through mixed fortune and sometimes in sheer misery. And that's just the way life is. The cosmos is is just meaningless flux. There is no point to time. There's no teleology. It's not going anywhere. We wander around sometimes in misery, sometimes in happiness, but there's no point to it all. And that's the idea of time in Homer. Now, there's certainly a great many other themes, and I think more important themes in the Iliad, but this is a fascinating one. Because of what happens in the next great epic poet in ancient history, Virgil. In Virgil's Aeneid, he, of course, is picking up on the Trojan War cycle, and he has Aeneas, the last of the Trojan princes, fleeing from the burning city of Troy with a number of survivors, wandering over the ocean. And Juno, the wife of Jupiter, the greatest of the gods, is harassing and pestering Aeneas wherever he goes. And she causes Aeneas and his followers to get caught in a great storm, and Venus, who is Aeneas' mother, goes to Jupiter and says, "Father of the gods, Jupiter, why are you allowing your wife to do this to my son Aeneas? You promised, you foretold that he would become great someday. So why are you allowing him to harass, why are you allowing Juno to harass him this way? He might die. The destiny might never be fulfilled." And so she begs for the life of her son. And Jupiter says, "Calm yourself, my child. Let me tell you his future." And Jupiter, in the first book of the Aeneid, gives her a prophecy that's startling for a number of reasons, not least of which is that he says, "Your son, as I predicted, will indeed become great. His sons and his sons' sons and his sons' sons' sons will be kings and will be leaders, and from you will come the great Roman race." And he says, speaking of one of his descendants, Romulus, young Romulus will take the leadership. He will build walls of Mars and call by his own name his people Romans. And then Jupiter says this, "For these, for the Romans, I set no limits, world or time, but make the gift of empire without end." And that kind of phrase could never show up in Homer. Jupiter says, "For these I set no limits in world or time, but give the gift of empire without end." And in the rest of the prophecy, Jupiter says, "These Romans will grow to be the greatest people in the world. No limits in space or time. They will rule forever. They will be the people. They will be all powerful. They'll cover the whole earth. No limits in space or time, but empire without end." And all of the rest of the Aeneid is focused on this idea of destiny, that there's this sort of upward progress. And Aeneas, unlike Achilles or Odysseus, the Greek heroes back in the Greek times, Aeneas sets aside his personal desires at the moment for the idea of something that he will never see, like Abraham, a city that he will never see, like other people who in the Old Testament walked by faith. We can see this in Aeneas as well, though the author is pagan. He sets aside, oddly, compared to the Greek heroes, his own personal desires because of something that's been told, something that's been promised to his descendants. Because now there is pressure to time. Now time has meaning. It's not a meaningless flux like it is for the ancient Greek heroes. And for the Romans, for the first time we see in literature, we see the idea that time is going somewhere. We see teleology, we see purpose, and we see an end. The Romans see down the road Rome growing to fill the earth and dominate it and be glorious forever. Well, they were wrong. There is an empire that fills the earth and dominates, and there is a king that reigns forever. It wasn't Rome. But it is very interesting that in the Roman age, for the first time, this idea spreads through the Roman culture that there is such a thing as teleology, that history is going somewhere. And here again, when we read in the New Testament, when we read about the the missionary activities of Paul and Peter and so on, when they talk about the kingdom of Christ filling the earth, when they talk about the kingdom brought about by the spread of the gospel, when they talk about the growth of the the spreading of the yeast through the lump, when they talk about God's kingdom growing, they're talking about kingdoms growing and time going somewhere and an ultimate purpose, an ultimate destiny. They're talking about a concept that the Romans are not unfamiliar with. If Paul had said that to the Greeks with their old idea of meaningless flux, he would have had a more difficult task to try and convey to them the idea that God is driving history somewhere, because the Greeks never thought about history going somewhere. But the Romans did. And because God in his providence had ensured not only that there would be a Greek language spread by Alexander the Great, not only would there be peace and safety on the roads and a common currency for the missionaries to travel in relative security, he'd also ensured that there would be ideas in the Roman world that would help to make the acceptance of the gospel easier, ideas that would make Paul's ideas resonate. We talked earlier about the idea of the city, about the idea of the body. Here we have the idea of time going somewhere because of what we see in Virgil's Aeneid. In my great books classes, we also read some philosophy books. We read Boethius. Boethius is a little bit less known than some of the others. Boethius was a Roman senator who lived around 500 AD. After the great fall of Rome in 476 AD, when Rome was taken by the barbarians and a barbarian king, Theodoric the Ostrogoth, comes to the throne, the Roman Senate still existed, and there were still senators like Boethius who still held to the old Roman ways. Boethius is a Roman, but of course he's a Christian because the Roman Empire is fairly thoroughly Christianized by now. But he's falsely accused and he's thrown into prison. He's given no trial and he's executed unjustly. While he languishes in prison, he ponders the loss of his reputation, of his honor, of his family, of his house, of his lands, of his standing with the king, and I think most tragically of all, of his library. And he thinks about the loss of all these things, and he says, what has happened here? How could God let this happen to me? Why do bad things happen to good people? And so he ponders this question as he languishes in prison. And he writes a book called The Consolation of Philosophy, where he generates a dialogue between himself and Lady Philosophy, who comes to him and she slaps him around a little bit and says, what's your problem? Haven't I taught you? Don't you know how to think about these things? And she engages in a conversation with him, which hangs itself on three questions. She says, let me ask you something. Do you know by what sort of governance the world is governed? And he goes, I don't. I'm lost. She says, do you know why the wicked seem to prosper? And he says, I don't. And she says, do you know what a man is? And he says, no, I don't. And so the rest of the Consolation of Philosophy is a discussion hanging on these three questions and the answer. And she prods him, and she draws him out, and she finally gets him to bring out those things that he had known all along but had forgotten in the midst of his misery. And she causes him to be able to answer these questions. But the answer to these questions is predicated on something she asked earlier before those three questions. She said, do you believe that God is sovereign? And he said, yes. The rest of your questions I can't answer, but yes, I believe that one. And so all of his answers and all the discussion, the wisdom that he comes back to in the end, I know what man is. Man is a creature who lives in a world apparently governed by capricious fortune. But I know that seen from the top side of the spinning wheel of fortune, it's the providence of God, not a mindless, capricious, arbitrary grinding of my life under its iron wheel. The providence of God is indeed sovereign. So he answers all the questions. I know what a man is. I now know how the world is governed, and I know why the wicked seem to prosper. They're not really prospering. It only appears that way. They're receiving their punishment even now in the fact that they're wicked. And there again is an echo of Plato, and also a very Christian idea. But the wicked are receiving their punishment even now in the midst of their wickedness, and a greater punishment to come. So he answers all the questions. He comes finally back to wisdom, and he's restored. He comes to an equilibrium, a calm of mind again, and he can go to his death with the consolation that philosophy, Christian philosophy, has given him. But it's predicated on the premise that God is sovereign. He has faith, and upon faith, philosophy can build. Later, in our great books, we read Anselm, St. Anselm, who lived around 1100 in England. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's one of the two great medieval philosophers, Thomas Aquinas being the other one. And Anselm wrote a number of books, one of which is called the Proslogium, and it's famous because in this book, Anselm generates what's called the ontological argument. It's been famous ever since, and people have battled and duked it out over the ontological argument. Is this a good argument for the existence of God? The ontological argument for the existence of God. And it's based on a chain of reasoning that goes something like this. God must, that thing that we call God must be that which is the greatest thing imaginable, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Actually, the argument goes further. That's where most people leave it, leaves it a very fallible argument. He goes on and he talks about the necessary existence of God. Not only must God be that than which nothing greater can be conceived, but God must be that who also has the attributes of necessary existence. It's impossible to imagine God whose existence is contingent. And ultimately, Anselm arrives at an argument for the existence of God that seems unassailable. I believe in order that I might understand. And then the proof for the existence of God comes. Anselm says, I want to find out if I can generate an argument that satisfies my reason for the existence of God. But it's not an argument that will prove me into a belief. It's an argument that will confirm for my rational mind what I already take by faith. I don't doubt. I'm not asking this because I doubt. I don't doubt. I have faith. I believe. Because without belief, there is no understanding. Without faith, there can be no reason. So he believes first, and then he says, and now that I believe in God, let me satisfy myself and my friends who've been asking me these questions, let me satisfy myself that this belief in God is also consistent with rationality, that it's a reasonable belief. And so Anselm comes to this position, this argument for the existence of God, that's predicated on already believing that God exists. So this argument is not an argument to persuade the unbelievers to believe in God. It's an argument to show believers that their faith is reasonable. So for both Boethius and for Anselm, we see this relationship between faith and reason. And that question, what is the relationship between faith and reason, that is a critical issue all through the history of Christendom for the last 2,000 years. And it's a question which has been asked and answered in the right way by Anselm, answered in the wrong way by the Christian church in the 1800s. And much of the mess we find ourselves in now is because we answered that question badly in the late Victorian era, when reason began attacking faith with Darwin and Marx and Freud and Nietzsche and a number of others. The Christian church backed away and said, gosh, I guess I can't answer that question. We'll just split the two and separate them totally. But for most of Christian history, they asked the question and said, no, the two fit together very nicely because faith is at the bottom, reason builds on top. So this is an issue that I point out in the reading of the great books with my students, and an issue that would only arise if we read the books right, if we read them completely, and if we read them in chronological order. The last, and I'll try and make this brief, but the last idea I want to talk about is the idea of decay in culture. Thucydides, the pagan historian, writes about the Peloponnesian War. The Athenians, who had defeated the Persians 50 years earlier, a great and arrogant and luxurious and prideful empire, become great and arrogant and luxurious themselves and fall. And Thucydides points this out. Livy says the same thing in a passage I alluded to earlier, where he says our society is sinking into this swamp of degeneracy because we've allowed the old teachings to lapse. And he says one of the most famous passages on the theory of history ever. He says that the study of history is the best medicine for a sick mind. For in history you find a record of the infinite variety of human experience, examples plainly set forth for all to see, examples for us and our country to take, find things to imitate as examples, and base things rotten through and through to avoid. The study of history is the best medicine for a sick mind. And having seen that in Livy, and then how he develops his history of Rome, we keep that theme in mind as we read through the great books, through the history works, and see the pattern of decay because of the lapse of old teaching. There's much more to be said about this, but let me try and sum up what I've said. I think that the reading of books is at the heart of education. And that's what the rhetoric stage should be about. The preparation for the reading of books is the study of language, and that's what the grammar stage should be about. In the rhetoric stage, when we're reading books, we should read the great books of the past as primary sources, not in textbooks. We should read them complete so that we can see how the author intended them to be shaped, and we should read them in chronological order so that we can see how God intended them to be part of the development of the history of ideas. As I said at the beginning of this talk, if you have questions, I would be pleased to talk with you afterwards. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Enjoy the rest of the day.